You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to another episode of Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves. We're recording this on the evening of Thursday, June 7th, joined once again by my trusty co-host, Daniel Sperry. Dan, we missed you last week, so last time we spoke, you were freaking out about the Warriors going into Game 5 in Houston. They get the job done in Game 6 and Game 7, and are now one win away of, I think being a dynasty. What's your thoughts on the Dubs right now?
Oh man, dude, last night was a whole lot of fun. The KD shot was, I don't know if it was as epic as it was last year, but it was pretty awesome. As a diehard Warriors fan, a longtime Warriors fan, you know, the thought of them even being a dynasty ever, even 5, 6, 7 years ago, was extremely far-fetched, even when they were making the playoffs and getting deep, but losing to the Clippers or losing to a Spurs team, and it's kind of incredible to be at that point. And I'm trying to think of like a fan base that I could like pull that in and equate to, but maybe something along the lines of like Red Sox fans who just understood that their team has been crap for so long. And then now, you know, they were on the verge, you know, the last couple of years, 2004, 2007, 2013, you know, they're a perennial contender and obviously a team that was considered for the championship year after year after year. So just, it's lucky to be a part of this, and it's incredibly entertaining and a whole lot of fun on our end of the spectrum. But I'm one of the few that's on our end of the spectrum, I assume. So plenty of people are probably on the other end of it or just waiting for it to end, which is fine. You'll have your moment in a few years. But for now, I will revel in this incredible run from the Warriors.
Speaking of incredible runs, Dan, we're in round one. We're talking all things Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup, folks. Over the course of Tuesday and Wednesday this week, we had the full round of 32, known more colloquially as the fourth round proper, and the first round in which MLS teams partook in the tournament. Just a brief rundown of the results. Louisville City 3-2 at home against New England Revolution. DC United survived North Carolina FC after a 1-1 draw through extra time. It was a 4-3 win in PKs for DC United. David Osted coming up really big on that. Philadelphia Union walked all over the Richmond Kickers. Chicago and Columbus played to an epic 10-9 penalty kick shootout after drawing 2-2. New York Red Bulls 2 defeated NYCFC's bench. Orlando City SC with kind of a hybrid lineup defeated now NPSL team Miami United. Atlanta walked all over Charleston. Minnesota United survived FC Cincinnati, knocking out the semifinal appearance, team that appeared in the semifinals last year, 3-1 in PKs after going 0-0. Nashville SC defeated Colorado Rapids, 2-0 in Nashville's first ever game against an MLS team in the Gary Smith Derby. Houston Dynamo walked all over North Texas Rioters. FC Dallas got a win on the road in San Antonio. Sporting Kansas City won at Salt Lake City 2-0. LAFC walks all over Fresno 2-0. LA Galaxy, mostly a bench team, defeats FC Golden State Forest. Portland Timbers 2-0 over San Jose Earthquakes. And Sacramento Republic in extra time, rightfully going 2-1 over the Seattle Sounders. We now have a round of 16 match. Dan, what was your general thoughts on the round of 32 this week?
The round of 32 was funny. It was fun. I think all the teams that I pegged for cup sets potentially got the cup set. I think there was a few more that we threw in there as, you got to watch out for this team, got to watch out for this team. But Louisville City FC was definitely one that we pegged for a cup set, and they ended up getting that done. Same with Nashville. On my end, I definitely pegged them for it. And then Sac Republic getting a – Sac Republic's always worth a cup set as they beat Real Salt Lake last year in the first round, like 4-1. Absolutely walked over them. So this is a – you know, there's a – It I love the cup sets and they're a whole lot of fun. And I always root for these USL and the lower division teams that get in there just because it is wildly entertaining when they go up against, you know, some of the best in MLS and get a chance to kind of get themselves out on the main stage, quote unquote. So I thought there were some really good upsets in there. There's also, you know, some really good performances from some MLS teams in there. I love what Atlanta United played really well. Andrew Carlton got a goal for them. Another one, you look at a lot of the player kids. The two player kids teams that reached that kind of stuck out to me was one Atlanta United, who played a lot of their Atlanta 2, and you got a chance to see some of the guys who have been their touted youth play for them. And then you have Sporting Kansas City, who started three players under the age of 20, the first time they've ever put four homegrowns on the field at the same time, with Daniel Shalloui, Gianluca Busio, who's 16 years old, Juan Kazan Juan Kamal, who scored his first career MLS or USL goal because he plays with Spoke Park Rangers as well, did that last Sunday. He started the match, and I believe he didn't go full 90, but he played a good amount. And then you also had Jalen Lindsay, who started at right wing back. They changed up their formation, which is very unheard of for Sporting Kansas City. They went with a kind of a hybrid 5-4-1, with the four being a diamond midfield. And then they ran with and they took care of business against the RSL team that was kind of in player kids mode, but kind of a very beat up version of player kids, and they just weren't up to the task. Sporting Kansas City took care of business, so that was impressive. I watched pretty much all of the Sac Republic game, and they were incredibly impressive. They really should have won that game 4-1. You'll
in
see,
regular time.
In regular time, they're really, like, if Brian Meredith hadn't stood tall and the defense didn't scramble a few times and clear stuff off the line and make some crucial blocks, you know, Sac Republic has that thing for nothing probably. So overall, you know, there was a dominating performance from Sac Republic. I believe they outshot Seattle like 26 to like 10 maybe. It was the margin of quality was shockingly pretty far between Sac Republic and Seattle. So that was a really fun one to stay up late and watch. My Earthquakes were terrible. I turned it off after they went down 2-0. That game ended that way as they lost to Portland, but you know, that was a team that was with mainly first teamers, and they played against a smattering of Portland Timbers 2, Vitas, and like Lawrence Olam, and that was about it. And they got absolutely wrecked, and they looked terrible for the most part of it. So that was disappointing there, but you know, there's a lot of good performances there from some upstart players, upstart teams. It was really good. I know Philadelphia Union didn't play a very strong opponent, but it was nice to see guys, a lot of their homegrown players bagging some goals that I think can help them, as they go through the regular season, can kind of give them a shot in the arm of confidence. Even though it was against Richmond Kickers, you know, you had guys like, oh goodness, the names are blanking me, but a lot of their homegrown players picked up goals in their big defeat of Richmond Kickers. So overall, you know, there's a lot of positive things to take from a lot of the quote unquote player kids movements. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens. I feel like in the second round. Or in the second round of MLS teams, which essentially becomes the round of 16, I think you see a lot of teams end up. You'll see which teams are really, really trying to win the tournament, and they'll come out really, really strong in this round of 16. The contenders for who's going to go deep in this tournament will end up kind of surfacing within this round. So you know, there's a lot of good matchups in the next round, but. Yeah, the round of 32 was incredibly entertaining.
I agree with you, Dan. I think there wasn't necessarily – normally this is the round that you watch and a cup set happens, and the Twitterverse of that particular MLS team that gets – Railhawks just has an absolute meltdown on Twitter. And that's kind of, that's not what I live for from this round, but that's what you expect. Like, this is the round of 32, like Loyola Chicago beating Tennessee. That is when these normal, these matchups and those sorts of games happen. And I wouldn't say that a lot of those really occurred. I felt like all the cup sets that happened or the ones that got really, really close were kind of expected. You know, Louisville City, I saw on Twitter a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of days, a couple of weeks ago, the Coopers, which is one of the supporters groups of Louisville City, tweeted that since 2015, when Louisville came into USL, there's no team in MLS, USL, or the NASL that has a higher points per game in the regular season than Louisville City. And I think Louisville City's at like 1.87, which if you're doing that in MLS on a regular basis, folks, you're in the conversation for winning the Supporter Shield every single year. So, you know, New England is a, I think, is a decent team. We'll talk a little about them in the roundtable, whether or not I think they're for real. But, you know, they started kind of a B squad. Louisville City was at home. And of course, you know, that turf situation with the two different grasses between the outfield and the infield, and then the AstroTurf, you know, for left backs defending that end of the field, essentially playing around first base. And then you have the mound infield, you know, it just environmentally advantaged Louisville City. DC United is struggling. Obviously, they were at the Maryland Soccerplex, so not really surprised that North Carolina gave them a run for their money. What else did we have? You know, you had Minnesota and Cincinnati. I figured I didn't make a statement. You know, maybe Cincinnati was, you know, gloating off of, you know, what they did last year. So that went to PKs. You know, FC Dallas beat San Antonio. San Antonio wasn't that great. And Seattle, they're in the dumpster right now, and they played decent USL opponents both on the road. So none of those were really that much of a surprise. I was impressed, and I think it was good for a couple MLS teams that I think needed a result to go their way. You look at Houston, you know, had two really tough road games last week, but it's still a really good team playing a lot of their bench players, and they all got goals. I thought that was good in terms of developing the depth for Wilmer Cabrera down in Houston. You look at Philadelphia, who had an absolute dumpster fire of a week last, especially in the meltdown they had against Atlanta with their bench players and their teenagers really getting a good result, albeit against a really bad Richmond team. You know, and then I'm not surprised at all that, you know, New York Red Bulls bench is better than New York City FC's bench. And then, you know, Orlando got a win when they've kind of been struggling in league play. So there were a couple of really interesting cup sets, albeit ones that I thought were kind of predictable or expected. And there were a couple of MLS teams that I think desperately needed a result, albeit against weaker competition, that ultimately got it. Dan, let's, you know, if you had to pick a cup set of the round, like, you know, a non-MLS team that did had a really good performance, independent of they won. So let's throw in North Carolina there as well. You know, was there one team that really stood out to you, you know, punching above their weight?
Yeah, it really had to be Sac Republic for me. I mean, I that was one of the big ones that I watched the full 90. But man, I think Cameron Iwasa played in an incredible game. Keep watching the next rounds of Sac Republic. You'll get to know some of these guys. Cam Iwasa is a very, very talented forward. He actually was signed by Sporting Kansas City last year, but could never get healthy enough to actually get minutes with Swope Park Rangers or their first team and never made the first team bench. So he's an incredibly talented player. He's finally healthy again and has been tearing it up lately for them. Another player, I can't remember the first name, but Bijev is a really, really, you know, he's got great flair, great dribbling ability, and definitely has a nose for goal. It was exciting to watch. And a couple of the guys for Sac Republic really stood out. Their back line is pretty solid. It's a group of guys that's been playing together for the last couple of years, period. So I think, you know, they got a lot of quality. They played really well. They played good soccer. They were direct. They were trying to score goals. They were trying to go at Seattle. They were almost had a 60-40 possession swing after the first half. It was like 59-41 or something like that. So, you know, they weren't trying to just sit back and bunker and counter, which is how a lot of times USL teams and the lower division teams get upsets. They went at it by just going straight at Seattle. And I know they're on their home field, so they really can kind of, they could kind of do that. But man, they were really, really impressive. And I know it was a relatively weak Seattle team that they threw out there, but man, that Sac Republic team was incredibly impressive in the performance that they put out for me.
I'm going to agree with you, Dan. I do want to give a slight nod to all four teams that took part in the two Southern California games that occurred. You know, LA Galaxy and LAFC both dealing with some losses as far as players new to international duty. Not necessarily Dos Santos brothers, but no Ola Kamara for this game. I'm not even sure that Zlatan Ibrahimovic was aware that the track and field stadium exists in Carson, California. You know, it was there were five players who've normally been with Los Dos this season who were in the 18 for this game. And, you know, you had a brace from Ariel Lassiter, the goal puppy, and a goal from Bradford Jamerson, who's finally back after his concussion. And then even though Golden State Force being an amateur team, they did a couple of really good things against a mostly LA Galaxy 2 backline. On the other side, LAFC, you know, doing a lot of work without Carlos Vero was obviously really impressive. And Fresno FC, you know, in just their second ever, U.S. Open Cup game ever. So I want to throw out to them. Last thing that I do want to say about this, there was a joke amongst Colorado Rapids Twitter last night, Dan, that Nashville SC was playing at Vanderbilt Stadium. So the football field home to the Vanderbilt Commodores, where they normally, you know, get blown out by Alabama. And there were American football lines and the full end zones painted black all over it. So, you know, I know Nashville's eventually going to be moving into their own soccer specific stadium, but essentially, since, you know, Vanderbilt football, it doesn't have anything coming up in really the next 3.5 months, I would kind of hope that they could just get to regular soccer lines, or at the very least get rid of the big black stains over there, so you can actually see the field lines there. Those are really my only other comments on the round. Go ahead, Dan.
I was going to say Nashville actually plays their games in the baseball stadium, but because of the Rapids, and the same with Louisville. Louisville has actually been playing there, has mainly played their games at a baseball stadium, but for the U.S. Open Cup, I don't know if they were asked to not be playing in a baseball stadium, or if they chose to move to, because both teams moved to a more consistent surface. So I wonder if that was part of it. I know because Louisville City ended up moving over to the University of Louisville Stadium.
Yeah.
And so then they moved over to the Vanderbilt Stadium. I believe that's the first game that I've seen of Nashville SC play at Vanderbilt University. So I've been kind of paying attention to them on the side here. But yeah, so normally they do play in a baseball stadium. But I don't, for the future, like you said, I don't know. If they do play there, it would be kind of interesting to see if they could do something about it. But it's hard to do already painted on turf, like a turf set, you know, that's already set that way. So we'll see what happens with it. But yeah, I definitely saw that when I was looking at the highlights of it. And it's really funky trying to read a blue end line in an all black end zone. It's kind of trippy there.
Yeah, and I realize the thing, especially for me, is just you can probably talk to this more from a goalkeeper, as you know, as a former goalkeeper, Dan, but just from the perspective that so an American football field, folks, is slightly longer but slightly more narrow than a soccer field. So, you know, the Sounders playing at Century League, their touchline is about where Richard Sherman is sitting down and tweeting during the games, but then say the touchline would be just inside the end zone. So pretty much the entire 18-yard box from a goalkeeper perspective is in the end zone. And so if you have the entire black painted end zone like you do at Vanderbilt Stadium, I'm just wondering, you know, having black field and then green on the outside of that with white lines interfering, trying to find that blue. Dan, at least from your perspective, like, how much is that interfering in terms of I'm a goalkeeper coming out of my 16 out of the 6-yard box to try and make a touch, and I don't know where the box starts and ends?
Yeah, and that's definitely a hard one, because I mean the turf fields that I've played on, it's been all green with white lines, and then the soccer field is in the yellow lines. But the end zones were never painted over, so I never really had to deal with that. But I can definitely see where that comes into play. I know the old college that I used to go to, the end zones are purple. It's purple colors and the golden there. So you're trying to weed through the purple onto the green field with the soccer lines painted in there yellow. I don't know if maybe yellow would be a better move for them going forward in the end zone there, because I know the soccer lines aren't natural to that stadium. If you go watch a Vanderbilt game, you're not going to see, you wouldn't have seen soccer lines on it 3 years ago. So I believe those were just brought on there. So maybe you could try and go with gold, although it kind of, or yellow, but that problem with that is it also kind of mixes into the Vanderbilt color scheme. But yeah, it is definitely difficult playing in a colored end zone. I am grateful that in high school that the only turf end zones that I played on were, you know, it was just all empty. There was no block writing or anything inside the end zone. It was just the empty lines on the field because it was a shared stadium, so nobody had any logos or anything on it. So, but yeah, I mean, it can be difficult for a goalkeeper.
Okay, good another, Dan. Like I said, like we both touched on, both of these are temporary issues. Obviously, Nashville, once they become an MLS team, we'll be moving to their soccer Pacific Stadium, and that won't be a problem for them. And then I haven't kept up that much on the news, but I think 2020, 2021, Louisville City will be moving to their own downtown soccer Pacific Stadium in Louisville, right next to Slugger Field, where they normally play their league home games. And I believe there is some ballot initiative about that. I don't know much details on that. This coming November. So if that in theory passes through, Louisville City will become one of the first USL teams to sort of move out of that baseball stadium standpoint. And I think they're looking at 10 to 12,000 seats for that, which I think is the perfect, example for a USL team in a market MLS isn't looking for in terms of being a staple second division side. Dan, let's move on to the round of 16 games. This will take place the week of Wednesday, June 20th, so about 2 weeks from now. And now we're officially separating into regionals, guys. So we have the round of 16 matchups locked, and then if you win that round of 16 matchup, you know the matchup. The winner of the matchup you play, you know who that's going to be your opponent for. I guess that'd be the quarterfinals or the Elite Eight if we're using March Madness nomenclature. So Dan, let's just go through the schedule and talk about some of the matchups we're really interested in. In the East Regional, we have DC United hosting Orlando City SC. And they will play the winner of Philadelphia Union against the New York Red Bulls. That's a really, really popular matchup in this tournament in terms of it going to PKs and insanity ensuing, usually in the favor of the Union. In the Midwest Regional, we'll have Atlanta United of all teams taking on the Chicago Fire. And then the only two remaining, or two of the three remaining non-MLS teams, Louisville City FC, will be hosting Nashville SC. In the Midwest Regional, we'll be having the Houston Dynamo hosting Minnesota United, and then Sporting Kansas City against FC Dallas. And then in the West Regional, LAFC hosting Sacramento Republic and Portland Timbers hosting the LA Galaxy. Dan, what do you see in these matchups? What do you think about some of them? And who do you see as being, there's going to be at most two, at the very least one non-MLS team making it to the Elite Eight. Who do you think that team or teams will be?
The matchups are kind of interesting as I'm looking at these, because just Chicago feels so out of place compared to Nashville and Louisville and Atlanta. I feel like Orlando is just thrown in there to where they don't have to face Atlanta United yet. It's kind of interesting. And I'm looking at that, like, it just doesn't make sense in Minnesota compared to the Texas and Kansas crew is weird, but there's not much else you can do with the west side of the bracket. So I guess this will all work out, but Chicago definitely feels like a random outlier in there. But I'm looking at these matchups. You have to like Orlando City against DC United. I don't like DC. I don't think DC United's cut out for it. Orlando City has been pretty good, although they don't do well without Dom Dwyer. So we'll see what happens. If Dom is playing for US Open Cup, then they might be fine. But who knows? Philadelphia, New York is going to be mayhem as always. Atlanta, Chicago could be weirdly entertaining. Definitely circling the Nashville, Louisville one, because that's a nice little kind of Kentucky land. I don't know what the right term for that region
KFC is. Derby is that too
KFC on the nose? Derby, that might be good, because like KFC and Yum, which is the KFC corporation, own like half of Louisville, so that might work. So yeah, that could be fun. We'll call it the KFC Derby and just leave it at that and keep moving. Portland and LA is gonna be interesting. I feel like they've faced each other a bajillion times the last month. You have LAFC and Sac Republic. That's gonna be interesting, but I think LAFC is gonna be too good for them, especially since this is where Sac Republic I think runs into a problem. is because for a lot of the MLS teams that were playing, they're doing in the middle of a 3 games in 7 days thing. And so their Wednesday game, they're looking at and they're saying, look, it's a sacrifice. It is a USL team. We could probably throw out something very similar to our USL team with intermittent bench players and hope that works, and get the job done. And so then they lose. The problem is that now, LAFC, if I'm looking, because I have the schedule pulled up for it, so LAFC and Sac Republic will take place on June 20th. LAFC will have not played a game since this break, and so they will be looking at that, and I don't even know if they have a game the following weekend. I'm going to pull up their schedule real quick just to see. But this is where I think Sac Republic is going to run into a problem, is that LAFC, yeah, will be in position. So LAFC will not have to travel. Their last game is June 9th. But then they have another game the 20th. And the game June 9th is in San Jose. So they stay within the time zone. Then they go back down to LAFC. Who knows? Maybe they have Vela back or somebody like that in case a Mexico crashes out or Costa Rica crashes out and they get Marco Urania back. Who knows? But you're looking at that for LAFC. And then they have a home game against Columbus on the 23rd. So they can sit there and they're probably sitting there saying, hey, you know what? We might be able to get away with playing a very strong side in this game. And I think that's where Sac Republic's going to go into and get it run into trouble there. So for me, if there's any cup set team that I'm going through here that has a chance to go to the farthest, it's going to be the winner of the Nashville and Louisville game. And right now I'm going to bank on that being Louisville, because Louisville has just been incredible the last couple of years. They could have been, if they had beaten, was it 2016? If they had beaten, Red Bulls 2 in the semifinals, they would have likely won the USL Cup and they'd be back-to-back USL USL champions. So this is a really strong team, very well coached. They're doing everything right. I believe they're hosting that game against Nashville. So if there's any cup set team that I'm banking on out of this round, it's going to be Louisville City. But I just think that Sac Republic, while they're very, very good, LAFC is going to put a lot more quality out than what Seattle put out the other night. And another really fun one this will be my last one. Another fun one to really circle and check out is Sporting Kansas City and FC Dallas. That has turned into a very competitive rivalry, not necessarily in the stands, but in terms of on the field and both teams pushing for success and a stronghold in the Western Conference. Sporting Kansas City and FC Dallas have been doing that for the last couple of years, and they've always been very good matches. Last year was crazy in the quarterfinals between Sporting Kansas City and FC Dallas. That game went to extra time at 0-0. Seth Sinovic got sent off for Sporting Kansas City inside 10 minutes. Sporting Kansas City defended a man down for 8 minutes. Aiko Parra got a massive concussion. Max Arruti got sent off, and someone else got sent off for FC Dallas. So FC Dallas were up a man, flipped down to 9 man, and then lost 3-0 in that matchup. So it was a wild, crazy match. Whole lot of red cards, whole lot of heightened anger. I won't say anger, but the blood pressure was definitely boiling. So that's another matchup you definitely got to circle.
Mm-hmm. Just one quick fact check for you, Ken. There is a pending, highly unlikely injury situations. It's no MLS team will have any of their players off at the World Cup back for the week of June. The week of June 20th, the tournament does kick off on Friday the 15th. This will be starting. Now, the first game I have is Morocco against Iran, and that'll be at 11 a.m. Eastern on Friday. So most teams won't even get through. Most teams will not have played their second group stage game by the time we get to a lot of these teams are having to make their final roster decisions. I'm really interested in some of these MLS matchups, Dan, just because in a lot of cases you have a team that's probably doing really well and competing for the playoffs in league play, but and another one that isn't doing well. So I look at, say, Orlando against DC. Does Jason Christ say, you know, we need to focus on league play since I really need this team to make the playoffs this year? I'm going to put it on a beeline out where maybe Ben Olsen, who's taking this tournament a little bit more seriously, is time. He DC has history in this tournament, unlike Orlando. Do they maybe play more of an A lineup? So then maybe you have more of a balanced matchup because you have a bench squad of a really good MLS team against the starting 11 from a not so good MLS team. I kind of put Atlanta and Chicago Fire in that same category. I throw Houston Dynamo and Minnesota United as well. I think in terms of you're looking at just pure quality on both sides, for me, the best matchup overall is probably Sporting Kansas City hosting FC Dallas, just with how seriously both coaches have made this tournament, all the youth that you have playing in. So even if it's a bench squad from both of them, there's going to be a player on one or both sides that's going to be worth watching. So I'm really curious to see how that matches up. And of course, I agree with you, Dan. I'm circling the Louisville City Nashville game and the LAFC Sacramento Republic game. I'm going to say that Louisville will be the only team standing after the round of 16 that is not an MLS team. But in any case, it's really interesting. And just remember, folks, that there's a new incentive now through U.S. Soccer where if you are the last team or tied for the last team, if you end up going out in the same round, if you're the last team from your non-MLS division, you get an extra cash prize independent of how far you made it. So say if Nashville and Sacramento both make it to the round of both make it to the Elite Eight and then they both get eliminated, they both get a little bit of extra money. So this final USL team is going to get a little bit of cash, as has the last PDL, the last UPSL team, etc., etc. So a little bit of an extra financial incentive besides the actual tournament implications. And in general, I mean, Dan, I think, you know, last year any fan of U.S. soccer who did not know about FC Cincinnati knew about FC Cincinnati for this tournament. I gander to say, even with Louisville City being one of the better USL teams, not being on MLS expansion, but being USL Cup champions, that if there was any chance right now for Louisville to put themselves on the map in terms of people knowing about them, similar to what you saw from the Rochester Rhinos or Sacramento, you know, going back to 2016, this is their chance. And for Nashville, you know, this is a run at being taken a little bit more seriously once they enter MLS. So lots to look at for that. Dan, I'll give you the last word on the segment. Any closing thoughts, or shall we head to break?
I have no closing thoughts on this one, so let's head to break.
Listeners, we'll be right back. We're talking about Ernie Stewart back in U.S. soccer and a whole bunch of other USMNT. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports, the Boot Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves. Joined once again by Daniel Sperry. Dan, this segment, we were talking all things USMNT. The U.S. has had a couple of recent international friendlies. They'll be taking on France this coming Saturday. And they officially have a new general manager in Ernie Stewart, former U.S. international. Spent a bunch of time coaching and being a technical director throughout different clubs up in the Netherlands, where I can't remember where he's from originally, or he just has a parent who's from there, or he grew up there. And most recently has spent his time as the technical director of Philadelphia Union. Hashtag trust the process. Dan, what are your thoughts on this assignment, and what the heck is Ernie Stewart going to do with this GM position that we still don't have a whole lot of definition about?
Well, I think we finally got some definition. As they, you can check the U.S. Soccer website. I included it on our article too, on Last Word on Soccer, about what the quote-unquote role is of Ernie Stewart, which is interesting because it's very, very, like, typical role I would expect of a general manager of any other American sport. Basically to work with the head coach in terms of filling out player profiles and making sure that the players that they bring in and the players that they develop are part of the technical setup that the U.S. soccer is trying to have. And he is supposed to work with a team of technical experts that are outside of the head coach and etc. that are trying to develop a quote-unquote the tactics, the style of play, all those kind of things. You can go check that out. I linked to it in our article. You can also see my rehashed bullet points of what those job description duties are, but it's basically what you would expect out of a GM anywhere else. So check those out. My hard part is that, like, I feel like this is a position that we're not going to be able to judge, as is with most general managers in sports ever, is this is a position and a place that you can't really judge until after 2 or 3 years, and to see what the plan is in the development. And so I think the thing with Ernie Stewart in this position is we are not going to be able to judge him on how he's doing and what's happening until we see, you know, let's say they win the Gold Cup next summer. Okay. So are they competitive in the Confederations Cup? Make sure that they're on track for qualifying for the World Cup. If they're if they're doing well through World Cup qualification for 2022, and we're looking at that, then we're looking at a successful Ernie Stewart. We're looking at a successful tenure for Ernie Stewart. So I, like I said, I don't think we'll see whether or not he has been successful until it's too late, which is part of the that's an issue with that job that I would have. But at the same time, that's interesting. He doesn't have full hiring and firing privilege of the men's national head coach, but he is the person to lead the search and make the recommendation for hiring to the board. Which it sounds like that's just part of the process. I'm assuming he's basically picking it, quote to it. But, you know, I like it. I actually kind of like what he has done in the big picture-wise with Philadelphia Union, where I feel like for a while Philadelphia Union were just, all right, we've got 20-something players on this roster, and, you know, we're going to get a head coach, and we're just going to attempt to go play soccer, and let's hope it works out. Now, I think recently with the development of the Youth Academy, and you've seen some of the youth players come in through and kind of make some appearances and play, you see a little bit more of a here is how we're going to play type of a feel from Philadelphia Union in recent years in terms of a set technical playing style and stuff that I feel like I kind of like now we're kind of seeing the fruits of what Ernie Stewart has been doing with Philadelphia Union. And I think those are positive things because I think the future of the Philadelphia Union are definitely being talked about positively. I think some of the other things too is that they don't have other good players that are in there that fit the system. And I don't entirely believe in Jim Curtin. But you know, that in itself is kind of, that's up in the air and a whole lot of moving parts. So when I'm looking at this, and if you want to judge Ernie Stewart and whether he's worthy of the job, I think he's there. I think it's fine. I think what he's done with Philadelphia Union has been fine. So there's not much else to say on this because, you know, like we said, I think there's still a lot of other parts that need to be filled out before we get a big picture of what this is going to look like moving forward.
I agree, Dan. In principle, I like this hire. You know, I think Ernie has the right approach. He's obviously, at least from my standpoint, I think he wanted somebody who, even if they weren't born into U.S. soccer, understands the American player, the American game, and understands Major League Soccer. And he obviously has that from the time that he spent playing with a member of the U.S. national team, observing the league from afar, and then obviously most recently as the technical director of the Philadelphia Union. But he also has a proven track record in Europe, and particularly in the youth development side. You look at any of the teams where he was technical director of AZ, where they did not have the biggest budget, where oftentimes even being technical director or youth director of the club, like his office was essentially an oversized remodeled broom closet in a lot of ways. And, you know, so you look at what he did in the Eredivisie, you could say that AZ under Ernie Stewart was almost like what Sporting Kansas City is now, where they're consistently contender. They're maybe not winning a trophy every single year, but they promote youth development. They've got a lot of young players. They move them along when the time is right, and they reinvest that money, and they're able to punch above their weight despite having a significantly smaller budget than other teams. And I think if you were to point to any of the criticisms of Ernie Stewart in his time spent with the Philadelphia Union, a lot of them are variables that just aren't going to affect him as the technical director of a national team program. Whereas obviously the Philadelphia Union didn't have the biggest budget. Ernie Stewart came in, it was kind of on the condition that he was appointed there to work alongside Jim Curtin. So maybe he didn't have a whole lot of say in the head coach, or he wasn't there long enough to determine whether or not Curtin was the guy to be. I agree with you, Dan, that I still have a lot of doubts about him as a head coach. And then obviously, you know, the big thing is we're just now starting to see the fruit begin to ripen in the form of Austin Trustee, Keegan Rosenberry, the other players that they have, and all the other guys we've never heard of that are currently playing in the academy, in college, or with Bethlehem Steel. So you're just starting to see the fruits of that labor, but none of that's going to affect Ernie Stewart. He's coming in, he's the head, he's going to not, you know, with 100% authority, handpicked his head coach, but it's going to be his guy, where maybe he was coming in and had to work alongside Jim Curtin and sort out some of the differences the two of them may have had. Philadelphia Union didn't always have the biggest budget. That doesn't matter for a national team program because your player pool is fixed. And if anything, you know, if we're to believe the reports coming from the Holy Trinity of American soccer journalists, U.S. soccer is running with approximately $100 million surplus in there. So if anything, there's a budget, there are coffers for Ernie Stewart to tap into if he wants to go a little bit more on the route. I guess the one maybe doubt that I have from this position and assignment, Dan, is Ernie Stewart's always kind of been a youth guy. He was a youth guy at AZ. He was a youth guy at the Philadelphia Union. I almost question is, you know, even though this is a position that needed to get filled first, and that I think Ernie Stewart could be the guy to fill that, I'm almost wondering if there was maybe another role down the line that was a better fit for him. And almost like, since this position isn't going to have total hands control over the youth program, if maybe he would have been better as like a youth technical director or a vice president and then in charge of youth development. I guess the equivalent would be, you know, being an academy director at a club team where, say, he has a lot of authority over the U23s, the U20s, all on down, and maybe he's not necessarily handpicking the coaches for those positions, but working with them, keeping track of the player pool, being or assigning someone to be in contact with someone like a Jonathan Gonzalez, like an Efren Alvarez, who you want to be part of the recruiting standpoint. I almost think based on his track record, he's better from that standpoint than just managing a role that's going to be so focused on the senior team. Let's move on to some of the big picture stuff, Dan. Obviously, he's going to be a head of and a big part of the head coaching role. There's been a couple of numbers, names floated out there. Who do you think Ernie Stewart is calling right now to say, hey, do you want to interview for the U.S. national team coach job?
I think there's three names in MLS that I could see. I'm not sure what they're looking at yet, but three names in MLS that I'd look at is one, Jesse Marsh, two, Greg Berhalter, and three, Peter Vermees. Those have been some of the most successful in terms of working with what they have, creating a style of play and identity, and going out and executing it at a very high level. That is what those three have done in MLS. If they're going to go the MLS route, that those are the three who I would pick from. The interesting thing here that I would actually argue might be more likely is that Ernie Stewart doesn't effectively take over the role until August 1st of this year, which is when any of the post-World Cup fallout will have already taken place. And so if they're going to look outside of U.S. soccer, I don't think those names will be part of the conversation until after the World Cup, when all of those things happen. Let's say Mexico have a bad showing. Juan Carlos Osorio, you know how Mexico is with their head coaches. Do they get rid of JCO? You know, all that kind of stuff could all be in play. I don't know where they're going to go yet, and he has not said where he's going to go yet and what he's quite looking for. Granted, he was just handed the position, and he doesn't effectively take over until August 1st. So if you want to speculate on MLS names, I think Berhalter, Vermees, and Marsh are the three best names that you could really look at in MLS, especially alongside Greg Vanney as well, if you want to make that four deep. But outside of that, I still think there's going to be some non-MLS names that are going to get brought into the equation here that I think Ernie Stewart will definitely take a look at. And I don't think we'll get a better picture of those, who they are, until post-World Cup. Because like I said, he does not take into the position until August 1st.
I agree with you on all that front, Dan. I think those three names are there. You know, if there was an obvious, if I had to bet money in Vegas right now on a man for it to be, I would actually put it on Greg Berhalter. He and Ernie Stewart go way back as players. They've had a little bit of crossover in terms of their time, you know, post-playing, so to speak. And I think similarly, they both have... Greg Berhalter, similar to Ernie Stewart, he's proven himself in MLS. He's proven himself in Europe, and you know, the faults that you might have in him are things that aren't going to impact him as the director of a national team coach. You know, none of the teams that he coached throughout Norway, certainly not the Columbus Crew, you know, have not been the richest of clubs. But again, that's not going to affect him in the same way it's not going to affect Ernie Stewart. You know, you're not paying these, or you're not trying to transfer in Cristiano Ronaldo. Your player pool is set, and it's not based on the finances you have to go out and acquire and recruit players in that sense. He's been a little bit tactically inflexible at times with the Columbus Crew, but he's been a little bit more mobile than that, and he hasn't been afraid to take risks. So I think that's a benefit. I just think that relationship there, maybe those two are going to be such two peas in a pod that maybe they're going to be the best. That said, like you said, Dan, you know, Ernie Stewart is in no way in a rush for this. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if you don't appoint a head coach until late into the fall. And obviously there's going to be a lot of movement and a lot more availability of prime non-American based candidates after the World Cup. You look at John, you know, okay. Dan, you floated out Juan Carlos Osorio. I think there's going to be a couple of other international candidates potentially out there, certainly post-World Cup as the European League start to get settled for the beginning of their club season. Obviously, I think these are two pie-in-the-sky options, but Arsene Wenger and Zinedine Zidane are both out there if the U.S. national team wants to explore them. But in any case, I think there's no rush for Ernie Stewart on this front in any way, shape, or form. I think he should do his due diligence on both the MLS candidates. I think he should take a good, hard look at the options that he has outside of MLS. Obviously, he'll have a lot of connections in the Netherlands if he wanted to go that route. If there was a coach who was interested in that and maybe was a good fit in terms of understanding the American player and the Major League Soccer player, but he has plenty of time. I would rather him take a couple of extra months and get his guy, the guy that's right for a job, and appoint them the week before the January camp roster is due for that stint for the U.S. national team at the start of calendar year 2019, then try and appoint somebody in September and October just to have a head coach for those couple of friendly dates that really aren't going to mean anything in the grand scheme of things. And if you ask me, Dan, I don't really care that much about the results of the 2019 Gold Cup. That can be an experimental tournament for all sense, as far as I'm concerned, with the new head coach and trying to figure out his player pool and the hierarchies within that. We haven't talked about it a whole lot, Dan, just because there's been a lot of fluctuation and the games haven't really meant anything to me. You know, the U.S. beat, you know, a really bad Bolivia team that made a lot of mistakes. They lost against, you know, a really good Ireland team that maybe has a lot of their ideas a little bit more formed out. There's been, you know, a couple of debuts, a couple of teenagers playing in. Obviously, the Yanks will be taking on Les Bleus on Saturday, who are in a very different mindset trying to be a favorite for the World Cup. Do you make anything of this recent friendly stint at all, Dan? You know, any of the performances, something tactically, an individual, anything at all?
There's a couple things that stood out to me, mainly from the Bolivia game, only because that was the only one I got to watch. The Bolivia game, I really loved what I saw from Keaton Parks. He is very, very cool and calm in the midfield. Very, very calming presence. Can make the pass, goes both ways. He's very good on the defensive end in terms of reading and timing and the interceptions. I think he's definitely one to watch for the future. That he was impressive. I liked what I saw from Tim Weah. I really liked what I saw from Josh Sargent as well. Rubin was okay. And I thought Julian Green playing in the central midfield, which is apparently where Dave Sarakan sees him, which was super weird. I think it could potentially work down the road, but I don't know what to do with Julian Green much anymore. He didn't impress me a whole lot. Joe Corona wasn't all that impressive either for me, but you know, we're gonna go back. You're gonna look at the Ireland game. I think I don't know how I feel about it, but as I said, I didn't get to watch it. The performances, from what it sounded like a few players relatively checked out, which I would expect of them playing June friendlies instead of being in the World Cup and post European seasons, considering that was a very heavy European roster. I'm not going to read a whole lot into the results. I'm looking more for individual performances. The collective optics and group performance against Bolivia was great. It sounds like the one against Ireland was not. I'd like to see, I don't know what I'd like to see against France. I'd just like to see them not get blown out of the water, and not look like they don't want to be there. I would like to see a lot of Tim Weah. I would like to see a lot of Josh Sargent. I don't want to see Bobby Wood playing more than 15 minutes. I really don't care. These are players that we all know about already. We've seen what they've done against a lot of the top opponents and top teams in the world. What I do care about seeing is these youngsters get a chance on a very large stage, and I want to see the most of that. And I would rather them look to do that than, you know, to run out a lineup of a bunch of guys who arguably could or could not be part of the next World Cup cycle.
I agree, Dan. You know, I like what I saw from Tim Weah. I like what I've seen from Weston McKennie as well. So there's a couple individual performances. But at this point, if I'm Dave Sarokin, play as many kids as you can, get as many different people on the field, give them a taste of international soccer, and particularly just have them get a gauge of where they're at in terms of some of their, you know, their peers that they're going to be competing against. You know, we know what we've seen from Kellen Acosta with the U.S. men's national team. You know, now, you know, they can get a barometer of where is Weston McKennie as opposed to where's Christian Pulisic. You know, get a gauge of where they are referenced to their peers so they know what they need to do when they go back to their club teams for their start of the European season, or for the few MLS players back in with their MLS teams, you know, after the breaks that's coming up for the group stage of the World Cup. So that's the biggest thing for me. I still don't think Dave Sarokin at this point is auditioning for the job. I don't think any of the minutes these guys get is going to be relevant in terms of impressing the future permanent U.S. national team head coach. I think at this point it's get a taste for it so you know what you need to do such that when you get called in the next time, you're better for it and you're more prepared, whether that's for another friendly, whether that's for the Gold Cup or hopefully a World Cup qualifier that goes a lot better than the hexagonal of the 2018 World Cup cycle went. With that, folks, we'll head to break and we'll be right back with the roundtable. Okay. Now, did you have any roundtable or rapid fire ideas, Dan?
Not really. There's nothing that, I mean, yeah.
There, okay, there let's find one more BS one just so we both have two, Ben. How about and pick whichever.
Let's do coaching hot seats since we were talking about that in the group last night.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, let's both do what did the union look like? Post Ernie Stewart, and let's do coaching hot seats.
You're good.
Welcome back, listeners, to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, The Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves. It's time for the roundtable, and Dan, we are starting with rapid fire. Chris Tierney, all reports out from New England Revolution is that he has torn his ACL, and he will be out for most certainly the rest of the 2018 season. There's been a lot of ACL tears this season so far, Dan. What are the Revs missing in Chris Tierney? And in general, I've been kind of impressed with what they've done recently. Are the New England Revolution legitimate in the Eastern Conference?
So I feel bad for the Chris Tierney ACL tear. I like what he's done. He's come on pretty strong at the left back position in recent years. I'm going to chalk this up as the turf monster strikes again. Turf sucks. MLS teams, stop trying to play on it. It's stupid. The Revs, however, I do think are legit. I like a lot of the attacking pieces that they have. They've bought into the system that Brad Friedel has come out with. My question is on a surface that sucks, like the one that they play on, and the artificial turf, and the high pressing style, that very energetic, very frenetic pressing style that that Brad Friedel has them playing. My question and my concern is that over the life of a season, they won't be able to keep up with it, because I don't think the I don't think the infrastructure in terms of health regeneration and all that is really there for them. And doing it on turf for more than half the season just probably isn't very good. I think they're a legit team. Whether or not they can sustain it over the entire season, that is a question. If they can avoid the injury bug, I think they're going to be fine. You know who else is playing really well right now for them is Teal Bunbury. And if Teal Bunbury can keep staying hot and scoring goals and playing really well, you know, this is a Revs team that might make a nice little push into postseason.
Absolutely, Dan. Moving on, listeners, we finally have some rumblings. The transfer windows are beginning to open about who that main attacking DP that the Sounders could be spending on. Garth Lagerwey, of course, widely reported and quoted as saying that they will be investing seven figures. That's $10 million potentially in total investment in a DP this summer to try and get their season back on track. And we have our first rumbling, Dan. This is coming from Peruvian forward, who will be with Peru at the World Cup, Raul Ruidas. He currently plays with Monacas in Liga MX, and then reportedly he has a release clause with the Liga MX club of $10 million USD, and his wages, depending on performance incentives, were anywhere from $900,000 to $1 million per year. So potentially in being a more main guy, maybe wanting a little bit of a pay bump post-World Cup, could certainly be in the DP range, possibly under the TAM range, other than the transfer fee or the release clause that would be the set transfer fee on this. I'll admit I haven't seen a whole lot of this guy play. I haven't watched a whole lot of the Liga MX during the Clausura, Dan, but on paper, this looks like a good move. You know, he's got 34 goals in the last two calendar years in Liga MX, which is pretty decent. And anybody who's on, you know, a club that's going to the World Cup, he's certainly a guy who I'm going to be circling on my list to watch. I guess the key thing here is, what kind of a World Cup does he have? You know, would you potentially looking at him playing really, really well? Maybe Peru gets out of the group and he scores a goal or something. Does that maybe up his price to where there's now other competitors in Europe, in other parts of Central and South America, other competitors in Liga MX for his services? Does Monarcas then potentially raise the fee for him potentially? How does that end up going out? It might be one of those cases where you're hoping that he doesn't get hurt, but also don't want him to play too well, or maybe you just look at some of your other targets. But at the very least, it's nice to see some rumblings, because Sounders fans haven't had a whole lot to be happy about this season. Boo-hoo, Sounders fans. I guess you guys invented collapsing out of the playoffs. Moving on, Dan, we've got two rapid-fire items that we're both going to be touching. We talked about what Ernie Stewart's going to bring to U.S. soccer in segment two. We haven't really talked about how this is affecting the union. Obviously, he's been the brainchild behind the academy and Bethlehem Steel and a lot of the youth movement and stuff that they've had. We both have our doubts about Jim Kircher being the brains of the operation. What does an Ernie Stewart-less Philadelphia Union look like?
I don't know what it's going. Hopefully they bring in someone who can continue the vision and the work that he's done. If they don't, I think we're going to look at a, you know, we thought Philadelphia was a mess a couple years ago. I think they're going to be right back to that mess if they don't bring in someone that can kind of help continue and take the vision that Ernie Stewart has laid out for the team, and that what he's been trying to execute for them. If they don't get someone who can take it to the next level, then that is going to be concerning. You know, we'll see what happens. Like you said, I don't think either of us are entirely convinced that Jim Curtin's going to be the guy going forward, and the guy to really help make it all come together in terms of the first team. But, you know, we'll see what happens. But this is Ernie Stewart's probably the best, most stable thing that has happened to Philadelphia Union since they came into the league. And I think it's going to hurt them a little bit to lose him.
I agree, Dan. I think for the immediate, for 2019, I think they're okay. You know, Ernie Stewart was there long enough for them to, for the infrastructure and the environment to be put in place to bring in Austin Trusty and a couple of the younger teenagers, particularly on the back line, into the fold. And I think for the rest of 2019, it's set. You know, can they get CJ Sapong back on track? Can they try and get David Akam working in the offense? And then while that all of that's happening, can the defense start to figure it out? And even if they don't make the playoffs, can they progress in some level? I don't think that Jim Kirchin's in any way on the hot seat. I don't think the expectations or the goal for the Philadelphia Union is to make the playoffs. I think the goal is just show measurable progress. Can Keegan Rosenberry be better than what he was his rookie year? Can Austin Trusty be better by October than he is right now, so to speak? And I don't think you need Ernie Stewart to be in place for that. I also don't know how much they're going to be doing busy stuff in the summer. That's maybe the one area for 2019 and into the planning of 2020 that they're going to be missing Ernie Stewart. I think the next big thing for them is, what do they do on the academy front, and what did Ernie Stewart say have planned in his brain, but not necessarily on player, on paper, or being executed as far as Bethlehem Steel is concerned, as far as the academy is concerned? And maybe you don't need to appoint, you know, a genius, all-encompassing technical director like you had with Ernie Stewart. Maybe that's, let's go out and get a really good academy director who can fill in the gaps where Ernie Stewart was there. Maybe we can, you know, find some other assistant GM or somebody else. I don't think that the void that Stewart is leaving is something that you need to fill with just one person. That said, I do think that they need somebody with smarts there who maybe then is appointing the right people to fill out all the holes. This is a wait and see. We'll see. You know, Andre Blake has been saying hashtag trust the process. So I guess Philadelphia Union fans, you got to hashtag trust the process and see where this goes. Lastly, Dan, we were talking about this a little bit off air channels last night. And this is something that I think both of us have been thinking about, both in the context of the teams that we cover and watch and just general in MLS. By this time last year, Jeff Cassar had already been dismissed from Real Salt Lake. We have not had a head coach firing so far in MLS. In the last 2 years, we've averaged about a third of the league has been dismissed sometime between the beginning of the season and the start of the next season. Dan, who do you have on the coaching hot seats? And you want to make any hot takes on who's getting fired?
Hot coaching hot seats. Right now I've got two, maybe three, but I think one person's hot seat just isn't hot enough yet, but it will be by the end of the season. First one, definitely Mikel Staré. They gave the San Jose Earthquakes fired Dom Kinnear after 17 games last year. After 17 games with Chris Leitch, they chose not to re-up with Chris Leitch. We're at a point here where they're going to be approaching 17 games with Staré, and there are going to be probably less than 5 wins in those 17 games. And I would be shocked if they even have more than their current 2. The Earthquakes are absolutely miserable right now. I think he's got to be at the top of the hot seat list. I think Anthony Hudson, someone that you cover as well, might be on the hot seat. Chicago, you know, this run of losses and poor form from Colorado, the gimmicky formation is no longer throwing people off. It is just down to the fact that they are not executing and it is not good soccer. So I don't think that bodes well for Colorado and for Anthony Hudson going forward. The person that I think is going to be on a hot seat towards the end of this is Ben Olsen. I think if he does not start delivering once they get to their new stadium and once they get Wayne Rooney in the fold, which very likely he will not, I believe that he is going to be on the hot seat to get out and to be gone at some point. So those are my three to watch at the moment. I think, we were having a discussion, like you said, off air, and Brian Schmetzer got brought up, but I don't think Brian Schmetzer's on the hot seat as much as Garth Lagerwey is amongst the Sounders fan base. Most people don't blame the Sounders issues on Schmetzer. They blame it on the roster building and the lack of preparation for the impending rebuild that would have been necessary for them. So I'm going to go. I'll say that Schmetzer is safe at the moment, but I think the two burning hot ones at the moment are going to be Anthony Hudson and Mikel Staré.
I agree with you there, Dan. I think both of those two are definitely on it. You know, the Quakes have not looked good. You know, if you're just looking at league competitions, as of the loss to Vancouver last Friday, the Rapids now have 7 losses in league play. That ties a record that they set back in 2014. There was the first set, they had 7 losses, and that eventually led to a 14-game winless streak to end out the rest of the regular season. With this loss to Nashville SC earlier this week, that's now the longest losing streak overall in terms of all competitive competitions the club has ever had. Obviously, they'll be taking on the Houston Dynamo, where they have a chance to either break their current losing streak, continue their winless streak, or set a new losing streak in league play and overall a record for the club history, which is obviously very ignominious. I think the big thing for me is, yes, I think Hudson deserves some blame, but a lot of this roster construction, I think, has to be put on Porrick Smith. They spent a lot of money on a lot of players who just have not worked out. Myself and Rapids Rabbi at Holding the High Line have both been reporting on hashtag Eignergate, as he's pretty much on the outs with Anthony Hudson, and all reports are is that they're looking to off him, probably on a free or a minimal transfer back to Germany. Combined their 4 highest paid players based on the salary information we got, Dan, excluding Tim Howard, who's obviously the highest paid player by almost a factor of 2, the 4 highest paid field players, I believe Skelton Gashi, Yannick Bolli, Joe Mason, and I want to say Stefan Eigner's 4 on there. They've combined played 90 minutes twice this entire season. They've hit on some players who just have not been able to stay fit and not been able to stay on the team, and some who've just not been effective in MLS. This is a collective failing from top to bottom. I'll let you talk a little bit more on the Quakes if you want. I agree with you, Dan, that I don't necessarily think that Brian Schmetzer is on the hot seat, but I would kind of put him and to a lesser extent Remy Gard in the same category, in the sense that I think both of those organizations are realizing that they're in a bad place, that they need to do some significant retooling. For Montreal, that's probably bringing a bunch of young players, probably selling Ignacio Piatti for a King's ransom sometime in the summer or sometime next offseason. And then for Seattle, I think it's pretty clear that all of their over 30 guys have just completely hit a wall. I have no idea what version of Roman Torres they're going to get post World Cup. Obviously, Brad Marshall's over the hill. Ozzie Alonso can't do anymore. You know, I don't think Clint Dempsey scored this year for Clubber Country in any competition, so that doesn't look good. I think the bigger question for those two is, do we fully embrace the rebuild? When does that happen? And is our current head coach the guy for the job? Obviously, Remy Gard's having feuds through the media with his own players. That's a pretty unhealthy situation. And Joey Saputo, you know, as an owner, has pretty much been a burn it down kind of guy. So I don't necessarily think Montreal being where they are is not entirely on Remy Gard. The Seattle Sounders where they are is not entirely on Brian Smetzer. I think the question for both those organizations, do we embrace the rebuild? And if so, are these two guys the man for the job? I don't have an answer to either of those questions. I don't think either of them are going to get fired this summer, but I do think that their jobs in that context should be evaluated for the coming 2019 season. I agree with you on Ben Olsen, Dan. I think at some point DC United has to start winning, especially as they're spending money this summer. One of my hot take guarantees for this preseason was actually that Ben Olsen would get fired before the second home game at Audi Field. Caleb Porter would take over eventually, and he would lead them to the sixth seed in the Eastern Conference. Not sure how I feel about that, but the first half of that is looking pretty good for me right now. The only other name that I'll point in there is Minnesota United, Adrian Heath. The defense still really doesn't have any idea what it's doing. The attack has kind of been meandering. You know, I wonder if Minnesota wants to be anything relevant in this league, especially knowing what we know about Adrian Heath and his proven failures with Orlando. I just have to wonder if you're thinking maybe you go out and get somebody else or just try something different to try and shake things up, especially on the back line, independent of how much money that team is spending. Moving on, Dan, let's finally go to our weekend pick-ems. All the ones that we have this week, folks, will all take place on Saturday. We'll be starting with probably the first and maybe only second really interesting matchup that we have of this weekend. New York City FC hosting Atlanta United FC. This will be on 12 p.m. Eastern on ESPN+. Dan, who you got in the battle of the super teams, the Eastern Conference with circular logos?
That is a great way to put that one. I'm going to go with a draw here. We'll go 1-1. Actually, no, I can't see 1-1. I can see 2-2 in this one, though, for sure. But I think the spoils are going to be even on Sunday. New York City FC have had, they're going to be trying to kind of get themselves back going after the loss in the U.S. Open Cup to New York Red Bulls. Atlanta, you know, both teams played a minimal amount of first team players, so that bodes well for them. I just think this is probably the better set for a draw. I think both teams are pretty even. We saw that in the first matchup between the two down in Atlanta. So I will go with NYCFC and Atlanta with a 2-2 draw.
I'm going to agree with you, Dan. I think both of these teams have high-powered octane offenses. I don't think either defense is going to be able to keep them out early or often. But again, I think it'll be an even play. Atlanta's, you know, now I think, you know, been in the league long enough to start and figure out Yankee Stadium. And they've certainly played each other enough that they figured out what the other one's going to do. It's just a matter of who executes better. I think that execution will be relatively even from the attackers on both sides. 2-2 draw. Moving on, this will be at 3 p.m. Eastern in the United States. I think it'll be a night game in France. I don't know where France's time zone is, but in any case, United States Miss National Team, their final friendly taking on Les Bleus, I believe at Parc des Princes in Paris. This will be France's final tune-up game before the World Cup. Dan, who you got in the battle between the red, white, and blue and the Blue Roosters?
Well, it's actually going to be in Lyon, but this game will. I'm going to go with France at this one. I love the U.S. Don't get me wrong, but there's no way they're winning this one. This is France's one of their kickoffs for the World Cup. They should be coming out and playing strong in this. I expect them to get the result. So I'll say 3-1 to France. Maybe Tim Weah scores a nice 90-second breakaway. You know, or not 90-second, but a 90th minute. Breakaway consolation prize, but I don't see USA getting much out of this one.
I agree with you, Dan. I think so much of this is going to be dependent on what kind of roster France plays. You know, if they're being a little bit more timid, obviously it'll be a friendly. So, you know, does Paul Pogba only go 60 minutes, only go 45 minutes? You know, are they rotating enough of the squad out to where maybe, you know, a U.S. team taking it super seriously, playing with a preferred starting 11 against a France team that maybe, you know, does a full line change at halftime? Does that maybe balance it out? I don't think it will. I'm not going to give a scoreline, Dan, but like you, I am hoping and expecting that it just not be a blowout. You know, I'd be totally okay with a 3-1. I'd be okay with a 2-0 where they don't look good. Just don't get blown out by this team. You know, and maybe one individual has a really good look. Tim Weah back in the country where he's playing in France. So maybe he has a really good looker. You know, maybe there's a random PSG fan there who gives him a nice little clap after the game. I'd be totally content with that. Back to MLS, folks. This will be at 5 p.m. Eastern on ESPN, following the ESPN broadcast of USA France. Columbus Crew hosting the New York Red Bulls. Like I said, 5 p.m. Eastern. Dan, who you got and why?
I am going to go with Columbus Crew on this one. They've been playing pretty well recently. I know they had the crazy match. Was it against Atlanta? The 3-3 draw last weekend. That was nuts. They are at home. It is the New York Red Bulls. So, oh, goodness. Sorry. No, I'm going to go with Columbus on this one just because they're the home team. I'll take that. It'll be – I'll say 2-1 to Columbus. Giassi Zardes gets a goal and Pipa Higuain gets another.
Okay, I'm going to agree with you, Dan. Columbus is a really good run, and Columbus is a really good home team, and they are playing at home. I'm going to go 1-0 the Columbus Crew on this one. Both teams had kind of a busy midweek game in U.S. Open Cup. Columbus Crew kept playing mostly a bench lineup, but they only had, I believe they were at home against Chicago, yes?
Yes.
They were at home, obviously. You know, New York didn't have to travel a whole lot because they were playing New York City. But in any case, they'll have to travel. So I'm going with the Crew on this one. I'll go with a nail-biting defensive one where maybe both teams expect to score more. But I'll say Giassi Zardes continuing his run of form to get a 1-0 win for the black and gold. And then lastly, this will be the nightcap for Saturday night. Only Saturday night game, Saturday night MLS games this week, folks. Portland Timbers hosting Sporting Kansas City, 10:30 p.m. Eastern. I believe the two best teams in the Western Conference right now based on standings. No, FC Dallas is in there. But in any case, Dan, two really good teams in the Western Conference. Portland's really good at home, but Sporting Kansas City has been good on the road the last couple of games. What do you make of this game? Who's winning and why?
As much as I love what Sporting Kansas City has done, two games, three, or, you know, they've got a lot of injury issues right now. Kyrie Shelton is maybe questionable for this one. We'll see what Johnny Russell is up for, considering he went 90 minutes in Mexico City on Saturday and then went 90 minutes. No, didn't go 90 minutes. He went like 80 something in Salt Lake City, over the weekend. So, or not over the weekend, last night. So I will see where he's at. I don't know how strong of a lineup Sporting Kansas City is going to play. I'm assuming Portland's going to give it their strongest lineup that they can. I'm going to look at this one. I have a hard time seeing Sporting Kansas City win this one. I could definitely see them getting out a draw on the road. But I feel like this one is pretty easy to be chalked up as a loss potentially for Sporting Kansas City, especially over the last couple of years. And last year they were in where they had three match in 7 day stretches. There was only once where they won all three of them, and multiple times where they won the first two and lost the last one in that leg in that setup. So I'm going to say that they lose this one. I'll give Portland a 2-1 win at home to Sporting Kansas City, just because they've been hot, they've been playing well. But I would not be shocked at all if Sporting Kansas City escaped with a point from Portland. So we'll see where that's at. But history in the current form for Portland, I think, and the travel that Sporting Kansas City and the injuries that they've been enduring kind of points towards Portland on this one.
I'm going to agree with everything that you said here, Dan. I'm going to say 2-1 to the Portland Timbers. It will be very much the Diego Valeri show on Saturday night at Providence Park. And lastly, Dan, not really an official pick'em, not anything MLS related, but since this is probably going to be our last, this might be our last recording before the World Cup kicks off. Dan, who do you have winning the World Cup?
I'm going to go with Brazil. I think they're incredibly deep. I really like a lot of the players that they've got. I think their path is pretty well set out for them. So for me, Brazil is going to be my favorite to win this World Cup. I do, obviously it's hard to ignore the Germanys and the and Argentina and Spain and, you know, all those kind of, big boys. But for me, I just look at this Brazil side, and I think they've got a whole lot of quality, a whole lot of pace, and a lot of players that know what they're doing. If they can make sure it's one cohesive, good effort, I think Brazil is going to run away with it for the most part. So for me, Brazil is my choice to win the 2018 World Cup.
And definitely a revenge factor here after the Red Wedding that they had, the 7-1 loss in the semifinals last World Cup when Brazil was the host against Germany, Dan. So I think definitely a lot of those Brazilian players, especially the ones who are on that squad, will be looking to avenge, you know, their really, really poor ending to their time in the tournament. I'm going to make two kind of predictions. I always kind of do a one with my heart, one with my head on this one. This is most probably Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo's last World Cup. Messi's gotten, he is the meme of, you know, LeBron James with both hands extended and an exacerbated face looking out at Ron Artest, and every single other player who is suited up with him for Argentina is Ron Artest in the scenario. He just needs one person to help him a little bit. So in my heart, I'm really, really rooting for Lionel Messi just to get that and put all the haters out. He can officially sit at the table of Argentine gods, along with not Baldomero Toledo. Why am I thinking Baldomero Toledo?
not an Argentinian god.
No, who am I thinking?
Diego Maradona.
Diego Maradona. Thank you.
Mario Kempes.
Yes, both of those were right on the edge of my tongue. So that's kind of my heart pick, my brain pick here, Dan. You know, the statistically, I would say, you know, the World Cup is still very much an old boys club. This will be, I believe, the 22nd World Cup of all time, hosted by FIFA. But in those 2021 prior, there's only been 7 different winners, and only 13 different nations have ever made the final. I think it's about time for one of those to change. Maybe I'm just picking it because Kevin De Bruyne is a ginger here, but this is one of the few times that I get to root for him. It's about time somebody else won differently, and I think this is the most talented of the non-traditional powers you have in a really long while in Belgium. So I'm going to go with Belgium actually shaking up. But you know, like you said, I don't think you'd be wrong for going with picking Brazil. You wouldn't be wrong. You have an argument in picking Germany. I think France are going to be boom or bust. You know, either they're going to be out in the round of 16 or in the semifinals. I think any one of those is probably a good bet for making an argument there. That is it for us, Dan. Time for last words. Where can people find you on Twitter? And do you have any last words?
So you can find me on Twitter at SperryDaniel94. My last words come from an experience that I had last week. Last week I got to go and experience Fenway Park for the very first time, which was an incredible, surreal experience. Got to do a whole lot of cool stuff and some behind the scenes stuff. It was awesome. For me, I came away from there sitting there thinking, wow, all of this tradition and all of this history, it's all almost ritualistic. And the singing of Sweet Caroline, as corny as that is incredibly awesome and ritualistic as you are there singing it, enjoying it. And I think that U.S. soccer and I think that MLS teams need to take a page from that and find the ritualistic, the consistent, this is a tradition. I freaking love Minnesota United fans singing Wonderwall after every win. That is awesome. Find stuff like that. Sporting Kansas City, you know, singing When the Wiz Go Marching In, arm in arm in front of the cauldron at the end of the match. Awesome. The San Jose Earthquakes, when they were winning, were going out and doing their thing in front of the ultras. There's certain chants and cheers and songs, stuff like that. As corny as certain things may be, I entirely implore MLS supporters groups, MLS teams and stuff to find a set ritual that works and a set thing that works and keep that tradition going for years and years to come, because 30, 40, when our generation, I'm in the 20s, but when my generation is in their 50s and 60s, and we're looking back at where soccer is at, I want to be able to go back and think of, wow, I remember when I was an 18-year-old in this stadium doing this, and now here I am 50 years old with my kids and my potential grandkids and stuff like that, and looking down that, we're all doing the same tradition. That is something that is incredibly awesome. That was something that, you know, be able to experience that tradition was surreal. And a lot of the traditions that are around Fenway Park was awesome, and I implore MLS to find those traditions and U.S. soccer to find those traditions and make that become ritual. That's my last
point. What Dan said. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at LUS Matt Pollard. Check out all of our written audio and video work. We will be doing some World Cup coverage of the CONCACAF teams and a few of the South American teams as well. Check that out at lastwordonsoccer.com and at lastwordsc across all social media platforms. Thank you to our sponsors, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of Major League Soccer, the USL, and your non-World Cup participating United States men's national team. Get your custom scarf for your group, your team, or just yourself at roughneckscarves.com. My last word on this, Dan, you know, we're going to be having, I'm still working on the interview, so I kind of want to tease it a little bit of somebody who kind of came up with a formula for picking a team when you don't immediately have a dog, you don't immediately have a horse in the proverbial race when it comes to the World Cup. I, of course, am of Irish and Dutch heritage, so I have absolutely nobody to root for. I might only be rooting for Kevin De Bruyne simply because he is a fellow ginger, but in any case, I'm looking at that. So whether you've been enamored with what Iceland has done from a soccer culture standpoint, you know, find somebody to root for, even if it's just in passing, someone who you're not as passionate about as you would say the U.S. national team, or for our Canadian listeners, north of the border, find somebody to root for. This is still a World Cup. It only comes once every 4 years, and you should find some way to enjoy it, even if your team or a player you like or somebody isn't immediately in it. Just find something to watch for, or if you just want to watch as a neutral and watch the absolute madness unfold, a la, you know, a fan from a team that a college that doesn't really do basketball and your bracket's immediately busted, find some way of enjoying it. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the U.S. national team has to be there for you to enjoy the World Cup. With that, folks, we'll see you next week.